It's the Alton Browncast recording once again from my palatial suite at the Monterey Plaza Hotel, where I'm here for the Monterey Bay Aquarium Cooking for Solutions Conference. However, the person that I'm here with has got really nothing to do with cooking for solutions, but somebody with a long history in Monterey, California. Tori Bielecki, who you know is blowing up things on Mythbusters.
Hello, Alton. It's good to see you.
It is good to see you. I have to come clean, unlike a lot of the people that I interviewed, Tori and I have actually known each other for a while. I've had the opportunity of hanging out with him and his family. It's one of the best days of my life.
I was a little concerned because it's like, you know, most people, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if people usually invite you over for dinner.
They do, but I usually don't go.
I would assume people are intimidated to cook for you.
Nobody looked intimidated in your family.
Well, that's the thing. They think they can teach everybody. They're like, oh, they're doing it wrong. I should have my own show. Let me teach this guy how to cook.
But I don't even know how you guys get to eat because you laugh so much.
Yeah, we had a good time.
I mean, I almost spit stuff out of my nose. I've never actually had to wonder what crab would feel like coming out of my nose, except at your house.
Yeah, I was hoping we didn't traumatize you, but it sounds like you had a good time.
No, it was actually...
That was good cioppino, wasn't it? It was all right.
I didn't want to just say, oh, it was all right. Freaking cioppino was definitive. But, you know, there's something about when the people that make cioppino have a close alliance or allegiance with the people that actually catch the stuff.
Yeah.
It's different.
Totally.
Because the relationship with the ingredients change. So you've actually got a long culinary background.
Yeah. I mean these – like my family has been – you know, I'm third generation in Monterey. My grandfather was a fisherman. His father was a fisherman. And they, you know, came here and fished the bay forever. I mean, sardines, we're right down the street from all the old sardine factories.
Before the fishery collapsed
yeah.
in the 70s.
But now sardines are coming back again, apparently.
They are. They're absolutely coming back. So, nobody wants to eat them anymore, but they're coming back.
They're my favorite, though.
I adore them.
Sardines are anchovies.
Them. Both of them. Yeah. All the little fish.
Yeah.
The little short-lived fish. So you came from a long line of fisher people, so
yeah.
to speak.
Yeah.
Your family, and certainly the time that I've spent with them, 90% of the conversations around food.
That's how we live our lives. I mean, it's really like we'll go on vacation. And it's like, okay, where are we going to eat for breakfast? And then we're done with breakfast and we're talking about
where
we're going to go for lunch.
Listening to the stories of your family's camping trips, some of the most hilarious stuff I've ever heard. You guys practically like built catering kitchens under
yeah.
tents because camping was just another excuse for cooking obscene amounts of food.
Well, and it was ridiculous. So an hour south of Monterey is a place called Big Sur, and right. we used to go camping there all the time.
Beautiful place.
And so the big Italian community here would go down there for Memorial Day and basically take over the campgrounds. The Rangers hate the Italians down there because it's just like it literally becomes
like moving in ranges.
Little Monterey yeah. down in Big Sur. But so my grandfather, he used to set up a kitchen in the campsite, and I'm not joking. He had a deep fryer. He'd have a grill.
With a deep fryer.
Yeah.
So he's running these off of like propane tanks?
Exactly. He would basically take his truck, load it up with kitchen equipment, get it down there. And it got so bad that people from other campsites started lining up. And he's looking around. He's like, who are these people? I don't even know who these people are. And I'm cooking food for them.
But he did it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was and it wasn't like you imagine you go camping and it's like, okay, what are we going to eat? Hot dogs? You know,
sure.
one night.
We're going to start a fire. We're going to maybe, you know.
Something simple.
Something simple.
Not him. No. He would have like fried calamari. He would have pasta. I mean, it was ridiculous.
I'm trying to remember the last time I was on a camping trip where I did fried calamari. wait. So you're raised in this amazingly food-centric family.
Yeah.
But you kind of blow up stuff for a living.
I do. It was
which is cool. I'm envious of what you do.
Anytime you want to come out to the bomb range, we can blow something up.
How did you end up on Mythbusters? Can you give me the trajectory that puts you in that?
So the way I got on the show, you know, I went to film school. Mm-hmm. We talked about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like to me, when I found out you were a director, camera operator, shot film, like when I found that out, I was like, oh my God, I got to talk to this guy. So I went to film school, and while I was in film school, I always wanted to do special effects. So I started working for Lucasfilm. So I worked on episode one.
I think I've heard of them.
You heard of Star Wars?
Wait, episode one? That one doesn't count, does it?
Oh, no. Man.
Episode one?
I know.
Was that Jar Jar Binks? Or was that? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was Jar Jar Binks. I know. We were working on this movie.
But you're working on Star Wars.
For a year. Like, so excited. And I remember seeing the sculpt. There was a sculptor there who'd done the bust of Jar Jar Binks. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, whoa, look at this alien. This thing is going to be so cool. And then when the movie came out,
he's a Jamaican dude.
He opened his mouth and it was like, you killed it.
He should do a reggae album.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
So you get
a job doing that.
So I went, did special effects, worked on Matrix 2 and 3. And then during that time.
Now, what were you doing on the Matrix films?
Building models and blowing them up.
Okay.
We blew up more.
Stuff blew up.
Yeah. We blew up more stuff on Matrix.
Were you busy mostly building the stuff or blowing up the stuff? You weren't on the pyro team.
Both.
So
I was working with the pyro team. I would build the models and figure out ways so that it came apart and looked good. And so I was working.
So that when the explosive happened,
yeah.
Everything would go where it was supposed to go.
Right. The gas bombs looked right. You know, because the worst thing you want to do is have a model that stays together after you blow it up. I know this sounds weird. People are like,
that happens though, doesn't it?
They're like, do you get upset after, you know, you've worked for, you know, a week or so on a model and then at the end of it you blow it up? And I'm like, no, I get upset if it doesn't blow up right. Like if it doesn't come apart.
Now, has that happened to you?
Yeah, there's times where you're just like, oh, that didn't look right.
What hasn't blown up right for you?
Just pieces don't come apart. Like they come apart in a big chunk, which is a dead giveaway that it's a miniature.
Can you think of one on the Matrix films that was oh crap, we got to do that
on
again.
On episode, it was either one or two where there was a scene. It was this reactor. They were blowing up the ship at the end, and the reactor in the reactor room comes crashing down on the other one, and the charges went off too late, and so the pieces started collapsing before the charge went off. It looked fake, and
right.
You're sitting there in the screening room, and you got the director, you know, George Lucas is there going, that doesn't look right, and you just spent, you know, however much, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars on that shot, and you got to go do it again.
And nobody wants to be the guy that tells George Lucas that.
No.
George, we got to go do that again.
Yeah.
We messed that up.
We screwed that up.
But that, I imagine that figuring out how to make things fly away from the explosion is a big part of what sells the explosion.
Well, you have to figure out a way to build. Usually you build these models and you're using fiberglass because you don't want it to break because it's got to last for the entire shoot. But when you're building stuff to blow up, it has to be made out of something that will stay together, but it's flimsy enough that when the charges go off, there's splinters in a ton of, you know, in a million little pieces.
So we're talking balsa wood and styrofoam?
Balsa wood, you know, thin sheets of plastic. You know, you carry these models out to set, and it's like if you breathe wrong, you could break the model before the charge goes off.
Do you have to actually build them around the charge?
No. We usually build them, bring them out to set, and then the pyro guys come in and wire it, and we're working with the pyro guys to, like, place it so that.
Yeah, but the charges often need to go inside.
So
you've got to build
so
ways
we have little,
to get into
little,
it.
Little secret compartments that you open up, hide it with the panel, and then set it off.
Now, I have to mention this because before we get too far down your story, and only because I get this from your mother, the yard, Halloween.
Yeah. I was a sick kid growing up. I used to.
Sick with what? What do you mean? What did you say?
I was like
sickly, like every disease and sickness.
No, like you, sick or? In the head.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's different.
I was a little sick in the head. So, you know, my birthday is October 30th, the day before Halloween. So Halloween was always a huge event for me, and I wanted to do special effects. So every year I would do this elaborate haunted house in front of my yard. I would turn my front yard into a grave, and so my parents had to put up for a month with this haunted house in front of their yard. And so
it took you a month to build it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And so then Halloween night, it was like showtime, and then people would come through, and it was like we put on this performance. And you know, I'd have my brother buried in a hole in the front lawn, which my parents let me dig a hole and put my brother in. I mean, it was crazy. We used to scare the crap out of kids too.
I heard that it was fairly legendary.
Yeah.
That I mean, there are like children in the neighborhood that are still scarred.
There's grown men now who come up to me and they're like, when I was a little kid, I was
you messed me up.
Yeah,
I'm still pissed off about it.
I knew about your house, and it left some scars.
But it's funny that when your mom was telling the story, she wasn't like shaking her head about, oh, there goes Tori again. She was actually kind of proud. I mean, she was into it.
Yeah. Well, I think there was a little bit of like, what is this kid going to do when he grows up? And wow, this
were there concerns about
yeah,
that
because
in your
it's
household?
Like, Who says, oh, I'm going to go into special effects? You know, it's like.
Well, now special effects, are, I mean, they're dying because everything's being replaced by digital.
That's true.
Physical effects are.
But I mean, like you, when you were like, I'm going to go into the commercial business.
Everything was crazy all along the way. I'm
going to be an entertainer. Who said?
I'm going to make a food show.
Yeah.
You're out of your mind.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. And we still know if it's going to work out, but all right. So
you're still worried.
Keep
huh?
going. So I stopped you. Yeah, we're still working. The progression then from Lucasfilm to MythBusters.
So while we were working on MythBusters, Jamie and Adam, who I worked with for years on commercials and movies, actually
Adam was at Lucasfilm.
That's where I met. Adam came on episode two. Yeah. Jamie had his own shop, and actually that was my first job out of college working for him. And let me just tell you, he has had that look all his life. Like as long as I've known him, he's got the beret and the mustache and the glasses and the white shirt. It was a look that worked for him, and
his brand is solid.
It's bulletproof.
Bulletproof.
Yeah. So worked with those guys. They went off to do MythBusters, the pilot. They did six episodes for mm-hmm. season one, mm-hmm. and then season two, they called me and they're like, "Hey, do you want to come and test for this show? We need some background builders."
And did you think for a moment that you might not do that, or did you really say, what the heck, I'll go do it?
Well, the industry was changing, and there was less and less, you know, effects. Like you were saying, everything was moving into the digital.
It was all workstations, yeah.
And so the shows, you know, that were doing practical effects were getting, you know, few and far between. So the work was starting to slow down, and it was like, this might be a good time to try this other avenue. But I remember telling Adam, I was like, look, I'm background builder, I'll build stuff and I don't have to talk. And he's like, no, you build it, we come in and we experiment with it and we talk about it.
Right.
But then like 2 weeks into it, it was too slow. So that's when Carrie, myself, and Scotty at the time had to become hosts. So it was seriously the worst day of my life. It was probably the worst year of my life because I didn't want to be in front of the camera. Dude, that guy was crazy.
Still is.
Yeah. He's a mad genius, Paul Verhoeven.
First word's mad.
Yeah.
Okay, so you tell Adam.
So
I'm not going to be on camera.
I don't want
to
be on camera.
And what does he say to you?
He's like, don't worry. You're not going to be – you don't have to talk. You don't have to host.
Just build stuff.
And every once in a while, you'll be on camera at building. They'll film you build. But then they were like, okay, the show's not getting done fast enough. You guys have to become hosts. And let me tell you, it was like – it was the hardest. I don't know how it was for you. I mean, when you did the pilot for Good Eats.
I was never supposed to be on Good Eats.
But when you did it, was it hard for you?
No.
No.
No, but it still wasn't something I thought I was going to be doing. I thought, that's not what I do. I'm supposed to be behind the camera.
Yeah.
I'll do it because we can't find anybody else.
Your brain works in a different way than most human beings.
Yeah. Yeah, my brain doesn't actually work very well at all.
Truly a human being. You might be an alien.
This is not your interview.
No, but when I was watching you, when I came on to do the Iron Chef judging, watching you work was like you had like 8-10 monitors going. You had like two earpieces, and you're just like, it's like, how do you keep all that in your head?
You don't. That's the thing. You don't try to hold it. You let it pass through you.
So you're a conduit.
I'm a conduit. It's like Rain Man. I'm not actually a vessel,
and I let whatever powers go through.
Don't think vessel. Think pipeline. You just got to know what to pick up and put through the pipeline at any given time, so that it comes out of your mouth at the right time. And at the end of the day, I don't even remember what I said.
Yeah, but that's a gift.
Well, I don't know if it's a gift, but it's a marketable skill, which is different. All right. So they come to you then. You did the first season.
So we started having to host, and you know,
but how soon did they know when you started the show and when you realized you
like
were actually going to be a co-host?
It was like 3 weeks into the show,
and that was strictly because the show wasn't getting done fast enough.
Yeah,
because
they had this idea: if Jamie and Adam had two build teams going, that they could hop back and forth between the teams. So it was like, while they're testing this myth, the team can be over here building. this setting up this myth, and then they would.
But there were never really two build teams.
No, there were. So it was Kerry and myself, and it was Christine and Scotty. So I'm talking about
Christine
season two.
And Scotty, okay, you're right.
And like I
this
said,
this is pre-Grant.
Oh, way before. Yeah. And like I said, 3 weeks into it, they're like, "This is actually slowing production down. We're going to break it up. Jamie and Adam, they're going to be separate. You guys separate, and you do your own stories." And every once in a while, we would do some crossovers.
And how did you feel about that? I mean, was that kind of like, oh, okay, or did you feel like, no, that's not what I signed on for?
I was terrified, you know.
Because you hadn't been on camera.
Yeah.
But you had been performing.
I was always behind the scenes.
Yeah, but.
No, I was.
Think
was
about
awful.
It, though. I mean.
Okay, imagine this. I always try to describe this to people.
Okay.
Imagine you're at work and you screw up. Normally,
every day. That's everyday life.
Normally, in a normal setting, you would hide your mistake, fix it, and then go show whoever, you know, your supervisor.
Yeah, you buy for time.
Yeah.
You play for time.
How's it going? It's going
it.
Great. Oh, yeah. God. Okay, I got to figure this thing out. With this show, it was like not only do they see everything, but they actually enjoy when you screw up. So it's like as soon as you start screwing up, the camera guys are right there filming your every move, your every mistake. So it was – it was a tough kind of learning process to get used to having basically your screw-ups broadcasted.
All right. How often did things screw up?
All the time.
Yeah. They must.
Yeah.
That crap can't work all the time,
no.
man.
No. And there's so many times where you're just like, all right, let's get this. And you know, you got to think about it. Every time we're testing something, it's you're building something from scratch. There's no, okay, you're going to build a rig that drops a fake body off of a crane onto the ground and figure that out. And you got 3 days to figure that out. And you're like, so every single myth is like a whole brand new challenge.
Yeah, because you can't go down to MythMart and pick up the pieces for that.
No. MythMart doesn't. Yeah.
So how much of this was theorizing? I mean, surely your experience of knowing cause and effect, of knowing I got to build this way because this has really got to turn out this way, because you'd experienced that so much with models and with builds, that must have come in very handy.
It was definitely movie special effects work helped, because when you're on set and you know it's not going right, now you have, you know, you're talking millions of dollars.
Click, 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 click.
Yeah,
click, click, click.
I was working on a movie called Bicentennial Man, which was directed
with Robin Williams.
Yep, and Christopher Columbus was directing.
Chris Columbus,
and we couldn't.
Who went on to Harry Potter?
Yeah, he did all right. He's done really well. But so there was this one effect that we were trying to get done, and it was like fake blood was supposed to come out of Robin Williams because he was a robot, and we couldn't get it to work. And the AD was just on us, and everybody was freaking out.
All up in your
because
business.
You got a whole film crew standing around waiting for your effect to work. And I remember Chris Columbus came over, and this is when I was just like, this guy is solid. He was like, how much time do you think this is going to take? And we're like, 10, 15 minutes. He's like, okay, we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back, as opposed to just sitting here watching you, because that probably doesn't help you. And he cleared the set.
And bought you the time.
We fixed it. They came back in, and it worked. So having to think on your feet with pressure definitely made it kind of prepared me for MythBusters.
Because you knew how to deal with temporary failure of things.
Yeah.
How to recoup and how to move on.
Yeah. The difference, though, is on our show, they actually like it when we screw up, because it makes it more entertaining. So, you know, our saying is failure is always an option. And whenever there's failure, it's like, as long as we get it on camera, we're happy. Like, if you can't get it to work, we'll get it to work tomorrow.
But you never end up with failure.
No.
Failure is just the story point that gets you to finally success. I don't remember a single MythBuster episode that actually ends with failure.
That's true. But it's kind of like this progression of failure, 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 and then
ba-ba-da!
We got it to work. Yeah.
Were there any times where you got it to work so fast that people wanted you to fake failure for a while?
Sometimes there were those moments where it's like, wait, this was too easy. This
too easy.
We're not going to have a story.
A 15-minute show.
How are we going to fill act one? Yeah.
Yeah, 15-minute show.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to happen in that situation where you're building stuff from scratch.
Totally, totally.
So now you're on. And at what point did you first see an episode where you saw yourself and thought, oh, Terry's rolling his eyes.
Oh,
so when you first saw yourself in that new role,
yeah,
Was your immediate response,
I suck?
I suck. It was awful. First of all, I was like, that's what I sound like? Because you don't really hear the way your voice sounds.
No.
You hear it a lot deeper, a lot richer.
To me, I sound like Orson Welles.
Oh, my God.
I'm like,
exactly.
I'm so awesome in my head, but I sound like a little girl. Yeah. So was that
like,
a shock
my voice sounds like Barry White.
Yeah.
It's like sexy. As soon as I hear, you know, it's like we watched, I think it was the first episode, and it was like, gosh.
Had you never seen yourself on camera before?
Not in that capacity, no.
But you
no,
something.
Not like that, where it's like actually watching you explain something, describe a, you know.
Shock, isn't it?
Oh, it was horrible. And I was like, I have the worst posture. Like,
a schlump.
That's what I look like.
I sound like a girl.
Yeah, it was horrible. So it took me a while. But then I got to a point where I'm like, you know what? That's who I am. Just embrace it. And then I just, you know, after a while, I just kind of forgot about it. But yeah, that was.
I learned to ignore it. I got to the point where I could literally.
I look a lot like Brad Pitt.
No. It's like, that's Brad Pitt. Oh, no, it's me. I actually got to the point where I could have a remote control, a TV remote in my hand, and flip by me without hesitating. That's when you know you've been doing it for a while. You're like, you don't even register that that's you anymore.
Right. But like, would you watch your performances? Would you watch your takes?
You know what? Well, because I, you know, on Good Eats, I picked up directing that show from the fifth season on. So I had to watch playback all the time.
Right.
And I supervised the edits, so I saw everything.
Right.
But I always hesitated watching on television because at that point I can't do anything.
Yeah, so it's like why
I can't fix it?
Why lament? Like just let it go.
It's like I didn't watch more than maybe three episodes of Good Eats on television, but I saw them go out the door.
Right.
So, but for you, you weren't cutting them. You didn't have final cut
no,
on Mythbusters.
But we had rough cut. You know, we would watch rough cuts, and I remember.
Oh, so you actually were in the edit room for a good bit.
Not in the editor room, but what they would do is send us a rough cut, and then we would give notes. And
now, what kind of notes would you give? Was it more about accuracy of things, or
it was like
what did they care about?
Where it was like, oh, it actually wasn't. Normally, it was scientific accuracy
within your
that's not right.
area of expertise.
That's not right.
I don't like this shot of me. Can you try to cover that in a two shot?
Right. Well, there were times where it was like, I don't like the way I'm being portrayed here. Like there was a couple of episodes where, and it was funny. My dad. It was probably the first episode, and they were painting me as like this kind of, you know, bad guy. You know, I was like.
What?
Yeah, it was weird. They would show me and Adam getting into arguments where it was like, wait, that was just us.
Well, Adam could argue with anybody.
Right, but they would cut it so it looked like me just screaming at him, and then he was like, oh, why are you yelling at me? Where it's like, wait, show the scene before where we're going back and forth.
That's cool.
And so I called my dad and I go, Dad, I don't know if I can do this. He's like, what's wrong?
Your first instinct when you were unhappy with it was to call your dad.
Oh, yeah, just because he's my – I call him for any advice.
He's your go-to guy.
Oh, totally.
That's fantastic.
Oh, totally. He's the best. It's like, Dad, you know, I got to buy this thing. Oh, he was like, look, you are who you are. Be yourself and don't worry about what they're doing on that show. I mean, he really just put it into perspective, you know, and he always does that. So that was great. Like, okay, this is another example.
I haven't seen a lot of that out of your family.
So one time we were out to dinner, and there was a couple behind us, and they had a little kid. And the father of this kid, it was like a one-year-old, was like, can I get a picture with you holding my son? You know, and I was like, okay.
And that's weird, but okay.
And I was like, okay. He's like, we love Mythbusters. I was just wondering.
Can I blow up your child?
Yeah.
I'm going to put a small C4 charge up its butt.
We changed his diapers. He blew him up. So my dad goes, why do you want a picture with it? Why do you want a picture with your son? By the time your son's grown up, my son will be a has-been.
Oh!
But the thing is, it's like, that's how we joke. And it was like, and that's how he keeps, you know, it's like he keeps me humble.
Wow.
Is that good?
That's a good one.
Perfect. I was like, oh my God, that's brilliant. And he's so right, that bastard.
I would have turned to him and said, Dad, wait in the car. I'll take you back to the old folks home later. You know, somebody's going to have to take care of you when you're old. So you finally get used to seeing yourself on camera.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, was there a moment where you're like, okay, this is a good gig?
Totally. I mean, like it was, and it still is. It's like there are so many moments where you're just standing around going, are they paying us to do this? Like, for instance, we were testing IndyCar races, and it was like, do you lose 10 pounds of weight after an Indy race?
Right.
And so I
drove an Indy race.
Got to drive an IndyCar for 66 laps at the Indianapolis 500. And it was like, I was like, are you serious? I get to do this? And, you know, let's just say the other people on the crew weren't as excited about
it. No, they hate you.
Yeah.
They absolutely hate you.
But I was like, as I passed them, I would wave.
What was your top speed?
We were doing, let's see, it was a tuned down vehicle.
Because they wanted you to kill yourself.
Yeah. So on the straightaways, I was getting up to like almost 200. And then.
You realize that most human beings have no idea what that kind of speed feels like.
Yeah, it was awesome. If you ever have a chance to drive an
should
Indy car.
Should you ever have the opportunity to drive an Indy car, you should not pass
you
it
should
up.
Do
well,
it.
Thank you, Tori. I appreciate that. Because, you know, they're calling every damn day.
Do you like to race?
I like speed just like any other guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I like the precision of it. The fastest I've actually ever been is on a motorcycle.
Oh,
except
yeah.
for airplanes. But, yeah.
How fast you go on a motorcycle?
Well, 140.
Yeah, that's. But see, that's
on
even.
A bike.
But that's even more intense because you're feeling the wind. I mean. Motorcycle
on a good bike on a straightaway that's not
much is what you're
you know what
say?
There's really no difference of feeling between 100 and 140.
Yeah, that's true.
It just because unless you're like going into curves, there's no point of reference.
Right.
This was out in the middle of Kansas.
Wow.
So everything was just green blur.
That's
on
cool.
straightaway. So it didn't really mean
was this
much.
For your show?
It was when we were doing Feasting on Asphalt, the first series.
Yeah.
And I was on this big BMW RT.
That's
and
awesome.
You know.
Well, I'm doing a race coming up in June. It's called the Gumball 3000. Yeah. And so I think we're actually coming through Atlanta. Like it starts in Miami.
Who are you doing it with?
DJ Deadmouse. He's got a
if something were to happen to him, tragic, you would need somebody else with you.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to you want to be my co-driver
I'm just saying.
It's his car, so I have nothing to say.
But if he were to suddenly
if he
pass
didn't
away,
feel well,
if he didn't feel well, if something happened the night before that left
maybe
him
you can't see,
incapacitated,
yeah.
in some way.
You want to come? You want to go drive the Ferrari? Yeah, he's
who? No, Tori, I don't want to go drive a Ferrari. What the?
Yes.
You know how many times I've driven a Ferrari? Wait, none. Okay, there you go. I'm completely impotent. I'm Ferrari impotent.
Oh man, I would imagine you might like have a collection of Ferraris at your house.
I'm a cable celebrity. What do you think that I have?
I just
dude?
Picture you in your like garage full of like.
You know what I have in my garage? I have an Audi.
That's it. That's it.
You look so disappointed.
That's it.
I used to have a bunch of motorcycles, but then I got into airplanes, and airplanes eat money.
Oh. There
airplanes
you go.
Eat money,
there it is. So. I got airplanes.
I got one. No, no.
I don't
no,
have cars.
No.
I have a garage full of airplanes.
No. I have one airplane. There was a time when I had two airplanes, but now I just have one airplane.
Yeah.
So I'm not.
Well, we're going to be passing through Atlanta, so I'll be like, hey, what's up?
Hey, what's up? And I'll.
And if you want to jump in, take a spin. I don't know if we're going to stay. We might be staying. I'll let you know if we actually stay in
when
Atlanta.
When does it start?
So it starts June 2nd.
Damn, that's right around the corner.
Yeah, we go from Miami.
This won't even air by then.
To,
this is past history, probably.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, probably.
Okay. Well,
so it happened already.
Yeah, it was awesome.
So how many days?
It was 10 days. We finished in Ibiza, and he's doing a big concert there. So
you're probably not going to like him at the end of the second day.
I don't care.
You don't care.
This is going to be awesome. It's like, I'm like, you want me to be your co-driver? Oh, yes,
please. He chose you?
Yeah.
Damn.
I know. I don't know why, but I'm like, I'll go. Yeah.
So you get to drive really fast things. You get to blow stuff up.
Yeah.
You're Santa Claus, dude.
I know. It's crazy.
I don't even know, how to
like,
address this.
It's not even – sometimes it's like, how are they letting us do this? I mean, I don't know what – like after Mythbusters is over, I don't know what – I'm going to have to become like a SWAT team – leader or something. Like, I don't know what's going to give me that adrenaline rush after Mythbusters is over.
Now, because I follow you on Twitter and stuff like that. You've been doing a little submarine time.
Oh, yeah. We went up to Tahoe.
I know. I was watching.
Yeah. Graham Hawks created this two-man submarine. We went to the bottom of Lake Tahoe.
It's not just a two-man submarine. It's a two-man freaking RV. I mean, it's beautiful.
It's ridiculous.
And it's got huge window space.
Yeah. They run about 1.7 million. There's three of them in the world.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, let's pick one up.
Yeah.
Jim, fetch me my checkbook, would you? Okay, so
apparently the owner of Red Bull has one. You know, Richard Branson, I think, has one. You know, it's like those
one
kind
and
of
spare.
Guys. Who buys a submarine? Those guys do.
Haven't you always wanted a submarine deep down, though?
Oh, dude, it was crazy.
What I want is, like, I want, like, an old U-boat or nuclear submarine. I want to become a global power.
I want an actual working submarine.
I grew up, one of my prized possessions.
Were you going to go take over someplace?
Well, I don't know.
You're going to take
threaten. I was a huge fan of the show Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea in the 60s. I'm older than you, so you may not remember.
I know that show.
I still have a Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea lunchbox. And so I always wanted to have a submarine.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just kind of like when you can have an airplane, you can have a Zeppelin, can have, any, but you're not real.
Right.
Until you've got a sub.
Well, now you can get one. You too, Alton, can have.
For 1 point what?
1.7.
And then what do? You just go diving around.
That's what I said. What do these guys
do?
Because they're very tight. I mean, it's
a tight fit.
It's a little claustrophobic, and it's amazing. But it's like what?
So once you're down there, what did you see? What is there to see in Lake Tahoe?
Dead bodies, tons of them.
Yeah,
because of the mob.
Yeah. There's the whole substrata of the
all these old mobsters in concrete boots is weird,
floating around like skeletons.
Yeah,
skeletons.
Preserved. They're preserved
because the water there is so pure.
Hey, look, there's Al.
You know, unless you're going to launch a missile at something, I'm not sure having a submarine makes that.
That's
much
what
sense.
I said. I go, why do you not have torpedoes on this sub? Like just little mini ones. If you
of
know,
course, like
if a great white shark's coming after you, he's trying to mate with you.
You could torpedo just a fish,
right?
Just, for a hell of it.
Just to see.
Right, trigger fish, 5 o'clock. All right, come bearing 180. Load tubes.
Yeah. Is that a blue whale?
Yeah.
Whoops. Aren't those endangered?
We're now torpedoing endangered marine mammals. I love this. So what we're going to do is we're going to look for endangered species.
It's very fitting, right? With the aquarium,
a block away. So my thing would be I'd want to go down to Florida, like Crystal Springs, and torpedo manatees.
You are twisted.
Sea cow, 3 o'clock. Come 190. Load tubes.
Torpedoes away. Fire.
And you get that great shot of the cutaway of them going through the water.
No one's going to care about that.
Because what everyone wants to see is like a manatee with its little cow, little calf thing. And then
no one's going to care about that.
No.
Yeah, that won't make the headlines. Alton Brown killing manatees.
Nobody knows it's you. You're in a sub.
Oh, yeah. You just go just dive. Dive.
Adios. Down you go.
Yeah.
Nobody knows it ever happens.
No, I mean, these things are crazy. You should.
But they're nothing without weapons.
That's the thing. Put some weapons on that thing.
Well, do it. Make a package that goes with it. You could probably charge another $500,000
for the aftermarket kit.
Weapon kit.
I love it.
Ballistic missiles. Small.
Yeah.
And torpedoes.
And what else?
We need countermeasures.
Yeah.
Because if somebody starts throwing depth charges at you, you need to fill that out.
And you got to have the chaff to
chaff,
somebody's
exactly
trying to attack you. I like that idea.
And if you blow ballast, will you breach?
The way it works is it's not like an actual submarine where you can actually dive. You have to move to dive. So it's similar to an airplane as opposed to using the air to lift you. You're using the water to descend.
So it's – yeah.
Okay. So if you're not moving, you start instantly rising to the surface, which is kind of a good idea because if
– if something were to happen.
Yeah. You're going to –
But no torpedoes.
No torpedoes, yeah.
I'm starting to question the validity of even having this thing. I mean, if you lived in someplace with a beautiful reef
– right.
You know, like you live down in the Keys or something.
Yeah, if you owned your own island, which you probably do if you're buying a submarine.
Because it would be super badass to like surface right in front of the place where you buy beer.
Oh. And or just have like some open seated, restaurant on the water and you just pop up and you're like,
hey,
let's go get cocktails.
Stop.
Yeah.
Or, it's like some people anchored in a cove someplace and you come up next to them and surface.
Scare them.
Scare the living bejesus out of them.
I like it.
But all of my scenarios are based on either damaging something or terrorizing something.
I know.
So,
you got a lot of pent-up aggression there.
But I love the photographs. I mean, the color was so
– oh, it was incredible.
How far down did you go?
We got down to 150 feet.
Okay.
The edge of darkness is what they call it. So basically, you get so deep that sunlight no longer reaches you. It was nuts.
So was it actually pitch dark or could you still see blue?
We got to a point where – It was not pitch, but it was dark. Like you couldn't see the instruments were glowing. It was pretty cool. Yeah. And what's crazy is we went over this like ledge. So there was two ledges. So it was just like a normal kind of sandy bottom at first, and then we reached this kind of cliff, and then it just dropped straight down, and we rode that down, and then there was like another plateau and another cliff, and it just kept getting darker and darker. Yeah. It was like, if something goes wrong,
well,
we're screwed.
I was gonna ask
down
you,
here.
Was there a moment where you're kind of like, what's our – do we have some emergency procedures?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Do you have ever had any claustrophobia issues?
I did, until I was buried up to my neck in sand.
I was going
to
say.
Yeah, we were testing a myth on pirates from Pirates of the Caribbean. If somebody, you know, that's how they used to kill their – a horrible way to kill somebody is you bury them up to the neck at the beach, and then when the tide comes in, they drown. So we were like, is that possible? Let's dig a hole. We were in San Francisco. We went out.
So this is basically see if you get out of the hole.
Yeah.
What this is.
Yeah. Okay. To see if you can dig your way out and how long it would take. And I freaked out. We had a backhoe. We dug a 6-foot hole. I got into it. They filled it up to my neck, and it was nerve wracking. But as soon as I got, like, they patted it down and I was like, I'm okay. I got over my claustrophobia.
And you got out.
Yeah. It took me like 2 hours.
But you got out.
I did get out.
I watched that. I don't know that I would have been as user-friendly as you.
Yeah.
In that one.
Yeah. I think I need to start learning to say no.
It's easy.
Yeah. I don't think these things through. Or like, hey, how do you feel about trying to get crocodiles to chase you? And I was like, yeah, that sounds kind of weird. Let's do it. And then you're standing in Florida at the gaping mouth of a crocodile, and you're poking it with the stick to try to get it to chase you. And you're like, maybe I should have said no to this one.
They're not that good on land, though. Short bursts.
Yeah, but if they
short
get
bursts.
You,
oh, yeah,
forget it.
Yeah,
you're, but you they know. Do this thing where they latch on and then they start twisting.
They do the roll.
Yeah. And they're basically just your leg. Because like, they're like, we need safety boots. So it was like, oh, a motorcycle riding boot. It's hard plastic.
Yeah.
If it bit him, his teeth would definitely not get through it. But it's like, if it bit and if it had actually caught my foot, it would have just spun my leg off. So you don't think about those things.
Perhaps you should start thinking about those things.
That's exactly.
As you move forward in your career, having survived thus far with arms and legs intact, you should think about that.
Think about the consequences.
Well, I don't
what
know. You seem to be pretty lucky. I mean, I've watched you do some stuff that looked painful.
Yeah.
Sickening.
Yeah.
Really sickening. too close to explosives.
Yeah.
How many times have you been like, wait, I'm not where I ought to be. I'm doing something I ought not be doing.
With the show, we have bomb techs, we have FBI, we have police, fire department.
You got experts up one side and down the other.
And they make sure we're safe. But there are times we were testing this one. It was we built this giant it was a non-dairy creamer cannon. So basically we took a 80-gallon steel drum, attached it to a hopper, filled it up with 600 pounds of non-dairy creamer, which you can buy in bulk.
You can.
Who knew?
You can.
I guess for McDonald's. I was like, who uses this much? We filled it up, attached an air cannon to it, put a road flare, and our biggest concern was the air cannon wasn't going to be strong enough to throw all that non-dairy creamer, which is very flammable, up into the air. So we had this flare on the top like a birthday candle. We hit the air cannon, and all of a sudden the creamer went into the sky, and we're like, yeah, it worked. And then
it caught on fire.
And it was like a 60-foot wall of fire. And then the wind changed, and that big wall of fire
was coming down.
Came to us. And it was just – we were all just like, oh, crap, we did something wrong. This is bad. Even the bomb tech was like, all right, let's check our underwears. Like, it takes a lot to scare those guys.
Why is that stuff so flammable?
It's like – fat and sugar, it's like perfectly.
When it particulates, it just becomes.
It's like napalm.
Kaboom.
Yeah, it's nuts.
It's kind of funny thing. We actually make napalm out of non-dairy.
Yeah, that's actually one of the main ingredients.
That's one of the main ingredients. Yeah. it may burn everything, but it's tasty.
Diesel and non-dairy creamer.
And non-dairy creamer. Yeah. Golly. And all the time that you look back, That's the worst thing you can remember?
That was one of the, like,
we did not calculate this properly.
Yeah, that was, like, really scared us for sure. Because we almost set the hill on fire. The hills are alive with flames. Yeah, big deal. It looks, so you burn the heavens.
You've flown upside down in things. You've been kept up for 5 days. You've been given hangovers. You've been – what's the worst pain?
The worst pain, and it was the one time I ever went to the emergency room, was we were doing Hollywood hang-on myths. And so we were hanging on to the ledge of a building to see how long you could last.
Uh-huh.
And they had a – this rock climber was doing the safety effects. And so I was belayed onto a crane, so I couldn't really fall the 60 feet that we were up from the building. But the director wanted me to fall a bit, so he was, like, letting out a bunch of slack. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he's like, well, the director wants you to fall. And I'm like, two feet.
Hey.
I'll fall 2 feet, but you have me falling 10 feet. And he's like, it'll be more dramatic. So
yes, in fact, it will.
I'm hanging on, and they –
do you remember the building, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
What was it?
It was a fire department test facility. So
yeah, it's their test tower.
It's a – empty shell, concrete shell, but there's windows. Mm-hmm. And so the second floor, they had a high-speed camera to get the shot of me falling through the frame. Mm-hmm. But what they didn't think is I might hit that ledge on the second floor window.
Ouch.
And so I dropped 10 feet, hit my shin on that ledge. And it, have you ever been hurt so bad that you see a flash of white light?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, a couple times.
And I was like, oh, that was bad. And I looked down and blood was just pouring from my pant leg. And I was like, I think I broke it. So they let me down, and I stood on it, and I was like, okay, I can stand on it. I don't think it's fractured.
Yeah, but you're all on adrenaline at that point.
Yeah, and it's just like gushing. And so the paramedics were there, and they, you know, cut my pant leg off, and they were like, oh, yeah, you can see the bone. Yep, there's the bone right
there. That's always what you want to hear from paramedics.
And then like, as soon as they said that, I'm like
bleh!
Yeah, the blood. I'm getting dizzy. I'm like, oh, my gosh.
Brian, hold my – I mean, excuse me, hold my ears.
So they're like, all right, he needs to go to the hospital. So
yeah,
they bandaged me up. The producer's like, don't bleed on my floor. You're bleeding on my floor in my car. We get to the hospital.
Bastard.
They give me stitches, and so
– stitches, the bone sticking out, and all you get some stitches?
No. It was – the bone wasn't sticking out.
Oh, they could see it.
They could see the bone. Oh. So it wasn't a compound fracture. It was just – the cut was so big that you could see my shin.
How many stitches?
I got 7 stitches, and it was the first time that I'd ever gotten seriously injured on the show and had gone to the emergency room.
Oh, but you got really good treatment, though.
Oh, they were laughing. Boom. They were laughing. They were like, how'd you do this? Oh, this guy always gets hurt. And so the next day –
insurance isn't going to cover that, by the way, because, you know, your production insurance covers.
Yeah, production. Yeah. Not my personal insurance, that's for sure.
No.
So we get back the next day, and the fire department's there, and like, oh, man, that looked like it hurt, and wow, that was crazy. And they're like, do you think you could do us a favor? And I was like, what? Could you sign the concrete next to all your blood on the ground? Is that sick?
But you know what? You did it.
I did it.
Of course,
you did.
That was
probably,
like, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah,
is what guy doesn't want to sign the floor next to his blood?
Yeah,
I mean,
right. That was the weirdest thing I've ever signed.
And that was the worst pain?
That was the worst. Yeah, yeah. It was awful.
Oh.
Yeah. Yep. Try that.
They gave you some for the pain, though.
They did, but I didn't take it.
Why?
Because I don't know. I was just like. I didn't think it was going to hurt that bad.
Do you
bad.
Still have it? Because I'll take it.
You want it? I got a bottle of it.
I remember breaking my collarbone and on a motorcycle on feasting on asphalt, and I took whatever they gave me.
You were literally feasting on asphalt.
You feasted on that asphalt. It wasn't asphalt. It was gravel, which
oh,
is why it happened. But I took whatever they gave me.
Yeah.
You're like, because it hurt so bad.
You're like, knock me out.
Please knock me out.
Yeah.
With a hammer, if need be.
Hey, do you like driving tanks?
Yeah, when I get the occasion.
I think you and I
tanks
should,
are good.
We should head up to –
there's a place up in like Minnesota where you go up and crush, crush cars.
I was just up there. I drove over a couple of minivans and drove through a double-wide trailer. I think we should go up there and just go crazy.
I have looked at going there.
Yeah. And the guns you shoot, like they have this – what was the name of it? It's the German MG –
You had me a German.
It was the German MG 42, I think it's called. And it's the one that the Germans had on the beaches. Where these things just mow down. I mean, it's like you would go crazy.
Because you've seen some firepower.
You like to shoot.
I love to shoot.
You would go nuts.
See, what I want to do is go up there. Because if you guys don't know, there's like this tank school. I mean, you can go and can. They'll teach you to drive tanks. And if you pay extra, you get to crush things.
Yeah.
My thought was always is it con somebody into putting more fuel in it and go to town.
That's what I said. I go, do you ever?
Let's go to town.
And just drive through the mall.
Drive through the mall. You know, I mean, let's go to town. Because I want to see the look on somebody's face when I pull up next to Walgreens and turn the turret towards them.
Yeah.
I mean,
they will lose their. Well, apparently, the town outside of where the school is, where this place you go drive tanks, they're concerned about this tank school.
Well, they should be.
They're like, your tanks are too heavy and they're going to rumble and cause buildings to collapse.
That's what tanks do. I'm in.
All right, let's do it.
No problem. I've even looked at where the local airport is, how long it takes to get up there.
Oh, that's right. You could fly wherever you want.
Go wherever we want.
Man.
If you could build some very small small bombs, we could drop them on the tanks. You know how to do that.
We'll just play war.
Do you know how to do that now? Do you have those skills? When the crap comes down, would somebody be able to turn to you and say, "Look, we need to blow up this, this, and this."
Yeah.
You can do it.
Well, when I was in high school, I was making pipe bombs.
We all did that.
I don't, recommend it. But we would take legal fireworks and make them illegal. And the chief of police of Monterey, we were sent these things off in the backyard. They came up. I ducked out of there.
But there was an incident.
I left my parents.
You left the scene.
I was doing it in the back of my parents' house, which was, my parents were like out of town and I'm like setting off bombs in my backyard.
You go to somebody else's backyard.
I know, right? How stupid is that? Try this at someone else's home, not yours.
Did you get caught?
No, but he came up later and was like, "Look, I did some research. I saw that you want to get into special effects, and your teachers say you're a good kid, and your neighbors all like you. But if I ever hear a noise coming out of this neighborhood again, I'm going to
be
up
raped in prison."
Yeah. And did you know that pipe bombs are a felony?
Yes,
I didn't.
Well, when we were all making them,
I didn't.
When I was a kid.
That.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, but we used to make gunpowder. I mean, you could buy everything in the drugstore back then.
Yeah.
Back when I was a kid, we used pharmaceutical-grade charcoal, sulfur, and saltpeter that we got at the drugstore.
Wait, you made your own black powder?
Yes. We had to. We didn't have any other way to blow anything
up.
You're
like a pioneer.
When kids want to blow things up.
That's incredible.
But the drugstore had everything, and they would sell it to you.
Yeah.
You'd be like, you'd be, 12.
Where'd you grow up?
Well, I spent some time in a small town in northern Georgia, and you could walk in and you'd be like, "I need like a pound of sulfur and I need a pound of saltpeter."
I love how
saltpeter.
You just you wouldn't give me that.
I need some
you got
sulfur.
Any can infuse?
Yeah. Cool. No, we had to make our own infuses. And then you went to the drugstore.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Then you went to the hardware store and you got your pipe and you got whatever else you wanted to make.
Yeah, totally.
And,
I don't know if you can air this. You're basically teaching kids how to make pipe.
No, I'm not. No, I'm not, because I'm not giving them percentages. And besides, saltpeter is much harder to find than it used to be.
Yeah.
Remember, I never understood why they were selling it in the first place. Not really. Why was the drugstore selling saltpeter?
I know.
It doesn't really do anything but preserve food and a few other things. It's not worth anything.
Doesn't it make your sex drive
go
down?
No. That's a complete...
Is that a myth?
Not true. Yeah, that's a myth.
Yeah,
it's never on Mythbusters.
I've tried it.
You want to test it?
I'm going to try it.
All right, what we're going to do is we're going to go online.
I have no desire to have sex now. I've eaten this whole bottle of saltpeter, and I have
no
desire.
No desire.
None.
Completely gone.
It works.
Who wants to take that?
I don't know. Crazy people. They give it to insane people, apparently.
Well, that's what it's sailors. They used to, like, on ships.
Right, because you got this whole ship full of
guys in hammocks.
Just all
boys and stuff.
Yeah.
But it didn't really work. They all got buggered. They all got it in the end. So, dream job, 5 years.
Dream job, 5 years.
Because you're a very hands-on guy.
I want to be writing and directing movies. Low budget, action, sci-fi, horror, whatever. But
to be low budget? If somebody came to you with $100 million, you wouldn't take it?
Of course I would. But I'm just saying I wouldn't mind. Like, I would love to do, independent, good little movies. It's like going back to that filmmaking,
I do.
We've talked about this where it's like, I want to shoot – before I die, I want to shoot a feature. I want to direct a feature. I don't care how it happens. If it sucks, so be it. I just – that's on my to-do list.
If it's okay for it to suck, have me be the lead actor because
You're a great actor. What are you talking about?
I've actually gone from wanting to direct one to simply wanting to act in one.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I'd be fine with that because I know both sides now. So do you.
But see, the thing is like if I were to put you in a movie, I would have to like because, I mean, you have a theater background.
I do.
So we would have to give you a character because you're so recognizable now that
– See? I've already got baggage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, is he going to cook something? No.
Maybe.
He's going to kill – Maybe. He's going to kill somebody because he's a psycho killer. That's what I would cast.
I could be a psycho killer. That's what nobody would really have – nobody that knows
cast you as a serial killer.
You know, when I was growing up, I never wanted to be Bond. I wanted to be the villain.
I could see that.
I wanted to be the Bond villain because they had the cool – it's like, where do you guys get these uniforms?
Yeah.
And how do you hire all these people who don't go into town and say, yeah, we're stealing spaceships up there in that empty lake crater up there?
I was like, how does he keep control over his crew?
It's like all these guys, and they're wearing sashes. Yeah. Okay? Does no one at the dry cleaners wonder, why are there 5,000 sashes?
And they're all – these guys just came into town. They're all dressed alike. they're acting a little shady.
This guy's got this white cat. And they're all going up the hill into this.
And they always have like hot girlfriends.
How does that happen?
I don't know.
How does the ugly guy with the white cat always have the hot girl?
I think it's just the power.
It struck me.
Girls like power.
That's when I realized that in the end, you know, Bond was just upset that he didn't have that much style.
Yeah.
And that's why he had to try to wipe these guys out.
Yeah. You know? So he was a little bit – he was jealous. He was envious is what you're saying.
I watched a lot of Bond movies growing up because my dad died when I was 10, so I was constantly trolling
Who's your favorite Bond?
Well, it's actually kind of difficult for me now. Okay. I mean, I'm a Sean Connery purist.
Of course.
But Daniel Craig is amazing.
Yeah.
Daniel Craig, Casino Royale.
He's like a new badass.
He's like what was written in the books.
Yes. He wasn't the suave.
No. He's a killer.
Yes.
He will mess you up.
Yeah.
And there's absolutely no doubt in that.
He will mess you up. Yes.
Absolutely. Yep. So chicks dig him, guys dig him. Sean Connery, was he really going to kill anybody? With what? A non sequitur? A witty comeback?
Right.
But my turning point. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with the original films, but
Roger Moore was my favorite for the longest time. And I know that sounds like, what? Roger Moore? But it was because as a kid, that's when I got into the 007 movies. And it was just like, holy crap, I want to be this guy. And then it wasn't until later that I discovered Sean Connery and then
– the originals.
Yeah.
Well, for me, the villain that did it for me was from Thunderball.
Okay.
Largo,
yep.
Who was had the patch,
yep.
And had the big ship, the Disco Volante, and they stole nuclear bombs off of a sunken Vulcan bomber.
Okay,
and the movie won a bunch of Academy Awards for underwater photography. Nobody had shot so much underwater stuff before. But so Largo, is the name of the character, right? They've just stolen these bombs, and he was the lead diver. You know, even with his patch, he was the lead diver, and he comes up onto the bridge of the Disco Volante at night, and he's still got on his scuba pants, okay? All the, you know, the neoprene pants.
Right.
But over his bare chest, he pulls a navy double-breasted blazer with brass buttons. And I was
and
like, that's
– I want to be a villain.
I want to be him. That's the guy.
Forget Bond.
Because that looks so badass. I can't stand it. Even as a kid, I was like, oh, my God.
You're like,
that.
Yeah.
Who pulls a navy blazer bare-chested over a scuba suit?
And, you know, the
style.
The girls like the bad guy.
Oh.
You know?
So you want to direct a movie?
Yeah. So that's kind of – I met the guy who created the Red Camera, Ted Shilowitz.
Sure.
And he and I have become good friends. He's been a huge mentor.
Well, tell him to just give you a few cameras.
That's exactly what he's like, let me know when you're ready, and we will outfit you with gear. So that's the –
I would take him up on that now.
Yeah.
Just say, I'd like to go ahead and have that in the house.
Yeah. I don't know when I'm going to shoot the feature, but I wouldn't mind having the cameras now. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you might be
inspired
by possession of the gear.
I love
Besides, you know, companies like that go out of business all the time.
Yeah.
So it's better to just go ahead and get it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if Red's going out of business.
Probably not.
I think they're going to take over the business. But yeah, so that's kind of the five. What about you? What's your five-year plan?
Double-breasted blazer.
Dang it.
Over the scuba pants.
James Bond villain. I want to be a James Bond villain.
You know, it's funny. I go through periods of my life when I actually don't have a plan. And I don't have a vision of what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And then I'll get it. Or, you know, I won't.
Yeah.
And That's kind of where I am.
Yeah. But do you think you'll go back to the filmmaking passion?
Yeah. Yeah, because it kills me not to. Yeah. I actually, when I'm not shooting, actively shooting.
Right. Because like on Cutthroat, you're just...
I'm a game show host.
You're just a talking head.
Thanks,
yep.
Dory. Appreciate
I've
that.
I've seen it. You're just a puppet. Just a you're, talking a, head. You're a meat puppet.
I'm a meat puppet.
Yeah.
A well-paid meat puppet.
You son of a...
I do okay.
But you would rather be producing and directing.
You know what? I don't mind doing that. It's nice to have part of your job be, I'm not going to say fluffy. I mean, it's a hard day's work, but it doesn't, I don't need all my cylinders charging for that.
Right.
So it's nice to have something like that, but you've got to be able to balance it with something else that does fire all of your cylinders.
Yeah. Well, okay, let me ask you this. You said you wanted to act in a movie. Yeah. Who would you want to work with? Like, what directors would you, like, jump at the opportunity?
Actual film directors right now?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a really good
question. Like if somebody said, hey, so-and-so's making a movie, do you want a role
in it? I'll be super honest with you. If Wes Anderson called me up on the phone today and said, will you work a year for free, I wouldn't even hesitate.
You would do it. Yeah, Wes Anderson's
I'm
awesome.
A huge Wes Anderson fan.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Whereas if somebody like J.J. Abrams called up, I'd say, screw you, Lance Flareboy.
Wait, who's J.J. Abrams?
I don't even know who you are.
Who is that?
Exactly. Yeah, I'm not going to do that. They could offer me, you
know. What has he done?
No, nothing. Yeah. Remakes.
Yeah.
Nothing. Although, you know, if somebody called up and said, would you do, you know, we need you to be the new Han Solo, you know, I might.
You might jump at that.
You know, I'll think about it.
I think you should do, maybe we should do a low budget James Bond movie and you can play a villain.
Could play the villain.
Yeah.
I'd be an excellent villain.
Yeah. Shoot it real low budget.
Like how much we've got on us together.
With GoPros.
No, you got Reds. You just said a minute ago you can get Reds.
It'll be the first feature shot on GoPros.
Has there been a feature shot on GoPros yet? I think there has been. Somebody shot a movie on GoPros.
Yeah.
It looked odd.
Was it good?
But, you know.
Darn it. I thought that was going to be our claim.
We could still do it.
Our claim to fame.
I've got friends at GoPro. They'll hook us up.
It'll be the first James Bond remake shot on a GoPro.
On a GoPro. Okay, so I'm the villain. Who are you going to cast? You're directing this film.
Okay.
We're shooting it completely on GoPros. Okay.
Yeah.
And you can only bring up kind of cablebrity people like me.
Oh.
So I'm playing the villain. Who's Bond?
Ooh.
Who do you put against me?
Oh, that's a good question.
As a filmmaker, you've got to make these decisions.
Yeah, yeah. So we can't get actors, no. We're talking about we got to get people from
cablebrities.
Cablebrities.
Okay. People like us.
Oh, that's a good
people like us.
Let me think.
Well, at least you were on basic cable. I was on extended cable.
Would Bobby Flay, would he want to
be Bond?
No.
Do you see that?
I'm just trying to think of like off the top of my head right now.
He's not suave enough to be Bond, do you think?
Okay, maybe we're talking I have no idea. I was thinking Ewan McGregor would be a good Bond, but he's
A-list.
I know, but
how are you going to get him?
He might be a big fan of yours.
Hey, Ewan, we're going to make a Bond movie, which we don't have rights to, by the way, with GoPros.
Yeah, and we're going to post it on YouTube.
Yeah, and we're going to put it on
we're
YouTube.
We're going to get so many hits. It's going to be views.
I have a suggestion.
Okay. Uh-oh.
Actually feasible.
All right, let's hear it.
Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah.
Bond against me as the villain.
I can see that.
Or the corpse of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh.
Which has probably lost weight by now, don't you think?
That's dark.
Is it too soon?
Too soon.
Crap. Well, by the time this airs, podcast.
It'll be plenty of time.
It'll be okay.
Yeah.
It'll be okay. Everybody in the room is still going to be like, oh, no. He didn't do that. Sorry. If there was another
there
food
was just
person.
A vacuum now, that was just created in this.
Do
you hear that noise?
See, I'm a villain. But let's say that we were only going to cast it out of Food Network, people. Then I still don't know if Bobby Flay would be.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking Food Network, and so that instantly I was like,
well, I can at least get them on the phone.
Yeah, I was like, who would be, I can't even think right now. Definitely have to.
Jim Pace, what are you trying to say?
You would be Bond and Guy Fieri.
And Guy Fieri? Guy Fieri would be Blofeld? We get Guy Fieri to be Blofeld? Actually, no, I think that Bobby Flay would be an excellent villain because he's got that kind of eyebrow thing.
Yeah, and if you put him in like the right suit,
right, like a Nero suit or something? Yeah,
a black turtleneck. He wears those.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. All bad guys have turtlenecks.
I think that maybe in drag, though,
would
be a good villain.
Put a spin on it.
It's like, I just like the way this looks.
Yeah.
And if you don't like it, I'm going to feed you to sharks.
It's a remake of a Bond movie, but the villains are now in drag. Maybe everybody's in drag.
Don't forget, I can get hold of Mark Dacascos, who played the chairman on Our Chef America, who's a big action star,
yeah,
big
kung fu guy. Yeah, you know, it's funny because
call him at home.
When I met him,
great guy, awesome guy,
hilarious, and we were talking about he was in one of my favorite movies. Brotherhood
of the Wolf.
And I was like, oh my God. And he was like, oh yeah. Like, he was so just humble about it. And like, it meant nothing. And I'm like, dude, that movie
was amazing.
Was insane. Kung Fu.
He's
such a
badass.
One
of the nicest guys. Yeah. But you don't know, you wouldn't know sitting and talking to him that he could kill everybody in the room.
Right.
Like, hold up his water glass, drop the water glass, kill three people, and catch the water glass.
Right.
It hits the
floor. Like real ninja stuff.
Super duper ninja stuff. He's got actually all
of
those skills.
Wait, did we just ruin it, though, for viewers who watch Iron Chef?
No.
Because everyone
knew. Everybody knew.
Oh, they know.
Everybody knows.
Not everybody, because I tell people that, and they're like, wait, what? He's not actually part of the lineage? His uncle? His uncle? No, I'm not joking.
Are you serious?
Yeah. They're like, wait.
Okay.
I thought his uncle, it says in the beginning, his uncle, he comes from a long line. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fake.
Okay. No. Although he's become quite the foodie through the years of doing that. I mean, he's learned a lot about food. He's one of those guys that no knowledge is wasted on.
You can't help
it. Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, you can't help it.
Did you enjoy doing that show?
Oh, my gosh. That was – thank you, by the way, for
– my pleasure.
For having me on. That was probably one of the highlights of my TV. Oh, gosh. It was just, it was special on so many reasons. One, I took my father. He was
– your dad, and we went out to dinner, and yeah, he was great.
And my dad was like, he was like, New York, I don't know. He gets nervous. What if we get mugged? I'm like, Dad, you're going to be fine. Like, you know, small town mentality. And just for him to be there, to get to taste the food, just to watch it all. But I have to admit, I was a little nervous. And I think Alex sent out a martini.
Yes.
And I guzzled it. And
she shot it.
And then as soon as it was gone, as soon as that went down, I was like, hey, this food is delicious.
I love
it. And then you took us out for dinner that night with your family.
And I got to see your dad walk into Times Square for the first time.
You got to go there. You took him on his first subway ride.
Subway ride. It was subway. Yeah, he saw us like first New York rat.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, that
you
was
literally,
fantastic.
You made that trip for us. And
He was a hoot.
Yeah, that
we
was
ate Barbudo. And it was pretty fantastic.
And the food, I mean, it's like, you know, you're sitting there going, how am I going to criticize this food? Like, this food is the best food I've ever had in my life. And I got to find something wrong with it. It's like, there's not enough. It's yeah. I think I said at one point, the truffles really outpowering the flavor of the prosciutto or the, you know, the mortadella.
Like you're just making up words.
No,
now.
But I'm sitting there going, what a douche. How douchey do I sound? Oh,
the truffles are overpowering.
Really?
But you got to do something.
Yeah,
it was pretty close though, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like a couple of points.
Yeah, something like that. That was like when you guys – that was a fun
day. It was a long day.
Yeah, for you.
Well, no. I mean, we do two a day.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I did the morning one. Yeah.
Yeah, 12-hour day. But it's a machine, and we can pump a lot of people on it. So
and everybody was so – like your whole crew was just so cool, so nice. So
it's in the smoke. We put drugs in the smoke.
Well, they were all very friendly to me, and you know, it was a –
well, they were fans. A lot of them were fans. Well,
it was a pleasure.
Yeah. What's it? Last question, because I just want to know, what's it like walking around being you after this many years on television?
You know, it's pretty awesome. No, I'm just kidding. I sometimes forget that I'm on a show just because we're so kind of isolated. We're in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Our shop's up there. It's not that glamorous. But you know, when you're walking down the street and somebody's like, oh my God, I love your show. Or teachers will be like, oh my gosh, you inspire my students to get into science. So that kind of stuff, you can't, you know, it feels so good. You're just like, wow, what we're doing is actually making a difference.
Tori, thanks for being on the show.
Alton, thank you.
Don't forget, kids, my traveling culinary variety show, The Edible Inevitable Tour, is probably coming to a town near yours. To find out, go to www.altonbrowntour.com and click on shows. Don't miss it.